Well, yeah, I mean,
this is continuing with Frank Gardner on February 21st, 1973.
Well. Yeah, and Tenelberg, well, initially they just had these Yagi arrays for the interferometers. Then the people were interested in going to higher frequencies and having a bit more resolution and gain.
Mm-hmm.
And well, when I came back in 1949, there were a number of proposals for antennas. Piddington had one proposal. It was something which would have been somewhat equivalent to the NREO, so 50 foot may not have been as big as that, probably would not have been enough money. Well, they wouldn't have been able to get as good a surface, I don't think, up there.
As NRL, you mean?
NRL, yes.
Yeah.
As a 50 foot, but for the whole. So that, and then John Bolton had the idea of another dish out of Dover. Well, the problem was sort of solved by. John Bolton digging the hole out at Dover and putting in the concrete and the reflecting surface. So that was the end of Piddington's.
Sort of a fait accompli, yeah.
So this was the 75 foot or something, the one that was used to, first one to sort of detect the galactic centre as a sort of distinct source of radio wavelengths. Well, most of the interferometers, I mean, they were lower frequencies, were there. There was quite a lot of absorption in front of the galactic centre. The missiles were sort of 400 megahertz. And moderate being with them. Well, after that, I suppose. Well, this antenna was used for a number of other searches, including one for deuterium. Which didn't turn out to be successful.
I don't think that was published, was it?
I think so, yes.
Yes?
This is Gordon Stanley, I think, published this.
Hmm. In Nature, or?
Oh, somewhere. I'm not sure just where. But it did get some. Well, it was a fixed parabola in the ground. I think it was parabolic, but it may have been circular. But, so you could point it to a certain extent by moving a central mast, so that they could get a certain amount of integration time on Sagittarius, particularly. But of course, no deuterium was found.
Yeah. Well, I didn't realize that there was a paper on that. I'll have to check that.
Yes, okay. It was Stanley Price. It was Bob Price from MIT, who was out there for about 1 year. And he had number of ideas. One of them was the search for deuterium.
Hmm.
It was successful. But then there was the Mills Cross, which I think it's probably fair to say the idea was conceived independently in Sydney, although it appeared subsequently that the idea had been described in Ryle's 1952 Ryle's Society paper.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if
you're aware
of that, you know all the background.
I don't know all the background, but
What I said in there was that if you introduced two antennas, one which had a beam, a wide beam in one dimension.
Yeah. You could synthesize it. You could
synthesize a beam without saying anything more than that. So, to that extent, the Mills Cross was just an embodiment of this idea. But no reference was given to Ryle at this time. And I think they were rather annoyed about this. And I don't think any acknowledgement has ever been forthcoming from Mills since that time.
This is while he was still in CSIRO.
Yes.
His first one was.
Yeah, well, that was 1953 that the Mills paper came out. The Ryle thing came out in 1952. But well, Mills' first cross was just a small one, probably no more than about 50 metres in length. Then after that, 1954, they started to open up the site at Fleurs with the idea of building this big, a big cross. Mm-hmm. So that this was 85 megahertz and been with it about 50 minutes. And then this sort of showed radio sources which didn't quite correspond to those which had been published by the Cambridge people. And then what's become now the 2C survey.
Right.
So it was quite a lot of. Sort of bad feeling created over this, I think. I think Mills should have handled it a little bit differently instead of coming out straight out and saying that. So that I am right. Wrong. Well, he was substantially right, but not completely. So the Cambridge people sort of more or less withdrew their 2C survey and went up to it. It was at 85 megahertz, so they doubled their frequency to 178. Did another survey, the 3C survey, which was pretty conservative.
Rather successful.
Yes, successful and conservative and successful, so all the sources in there have continued to be sources.
Right, but now
the Cambridge withdrawal of the 2C survey, was this ever formally done, or did they just sort of stop talking about it? Or?
I think they stopped talking about it. Well, one of the principal, or one of the authors in that, it was John Thompson, who went to travel rather than worked on the moon radar afterwards. He said that during his time at Cambridge, that was a thing that could never be referred to. Not in Ryle's presence.
Right.
So apparently he was rather upset by it all.
But I don't quite understand. I mean, he was part of it, though. I mean, it's just something he wanted to forget about.
Wanted to forget about, yes.
Yeah.
So after that, they were a bit more careful
about
what they published. Although there was also this other method for this PMD. You know this one, do you?
I'm not sure.
Which you have an interferometer, instead of sorting out the sources themselves, you look at the probability distribution of what comes out of the interferometer.
Yeah.
And that, according to some theory which is developed mainly by Scheuer, should give you something about the source counts or something.
I see.
But I don't think this has ever really been accepted by people, and it's all been superseded by higher resolution.
The trouble with the Cambridge 2C was the confusion.
Yes, problem. Confusion, yes. They picked out too many sources per primary thing. You can't do this.
Right.
Well, people know that now. They didn't.
Well, there was great discussion, for instance, at the Paris Symposium about...
Yes, 1958, yes.
Yeah. Mm. But now, you said Mills... wasn't completely right too. Did he have confusion?
Oh, he had some of these extended sources, which with a few exceptions, were not really extended sources. Either they were spurious things, or in some cases there were just a number of point sources which just happened to be close together.
I see.
Well, Scheuer looked at these with the Parkes telescope trying to came into. Operation in 1962. So I think, apart from that, the Mills survey was substantially right. It took a long time to produce. I mean, papers were still coming out in 1960, end of 61, I think the last paper came out, even though the telescope started operation in 1955. Well, I think it was about 1955, the first synthesis paper came out from Ryle.
Something like that, right?
I mean, the idea was pretty simple. When I'd been in Cambridge, starting in 47, Radcliffe gave a very excellent course on Fourier transforms, which covered all these sort of applications. And he could have very well just got up there, gone on a bit longer one day, described aperture synthesis. I mean, it was just there to be described, but he didn't do this. But it wasn't a surprise to anyone who realised the background for a theory at Cambridge that this was a simple way.
But indeed, do you think that Ryle is the one that should be credited with...
For
astronomical possibilities?
Yes, I think for astronomical possibilities, but... I think Ratcliffe could have said it 7 or 8 years earlier. If he just... Well, first, I think people have to see the need for...
Yeah, some the time has to be right for it. Yes.
Yeah. And it wasn't right in 1947, 48.
Sure.
So I think all sort of discoveries people have not to other people, not just to themselves. You don't just... The idea just doesn't just come to you out of the vacuum.
Yeah, that's certainly true. But now, about this time, you yourself were not directly involved in all of this you've been talking about.
No, well, the nearest I'd got to radio astronomy was when I came back from Cambridge. Horsey has had this idea of measuring the temperature of the ionosphere by measuring the thermal radiation in the ionosphere. And the attenuation of the ionosphere is maximum, sort of 2 megahertz. So the idea was to try and measure the noise level of the 2 megahertz with some simple form of radiometer. But when you come to do this, you find that the sort of radiation sort of is down by sort of a thousandth of the sort of field strength that people normally use in radio communication. So, and there was one big source of noise is sort of just the radiation associated with cities, and even if you go a moderate distance from them, it's not reflected off the ionosphere. So first we went down to a valley which was a bit outside Sydney, about 35 miles. There we did get low temperatures during the day when the ionosphere attenuation was high, I think it's the order of 1,000 degrees. But it still appeared that probably a component of man-made noise in this temperature. So after that we went further west and where you were able to measure the ionosphere radiation during the day. Got sort of temperatures of the order of 220 degrees K. And well, this got us interested in some of the structure of the ionosphere in the lowest part of the ionosphere where there's some sort of things going on. And we did a number of sort of pulse experiments in trying to determine the structure of this so that we could locate the region where the absorption is occurring. And with moderate success, we might show that this was somewhere about 80 kilometres, and the temperature there was about 220. And there were sort of some differences with the season, but there were differences associated with these flare events on the sun and so on. All of which could be interpreted pretty easily as when a flare occurs, the absorption occurs lower down, and on that picture of the temperature distribution in the atmosphere, the temperature increases as you go down below 80 kilometers.
So this is 53, 54?
Yes, 52 to 51. Well, what about 50? Oh yes, going on to 50 to about 53.
And what about the Jupiter?
Well, the Jupiter. Well, in 1955, Burke and Franklin announced this discovery of the radiation from Jupiter. Of course, Horsey was very interested in that, and it was just the ionosphere projects had come to the end that I didn't have anything much to do with them, so he suggested that I should go in on this. This was at the time when the Shane Cross was just nearing completion. And the records obtained with a fan beam of this array did show Jupiter's radiation, but we wanted something to cover it over a great period of the day. And so that we just set up some simple interferometer in which we could get sort of two overlapping lobe sets so that we could determine the direction to to identify the radiation as Jupiter's.
Well,
this was being set up while Alec Shane looked over his old records, which were taken of sort of cosmic noise around 1950 and 51, and these, of course, had these Jupiter bursts in them. And he was able to show for the first time that the things had this rotation period about 10 hours.
Because he had such a large sample of...
Well, you don't need a very big sample, but it was quite adequate. And more or less inferred that it was just coming from a few one or two sectors on Jupiter. And with the limited data he had then, he suggested that the radiation was coming from some white spot on Jupiter. Well, with the observations we made in 1955, 56, we were able to show that the rotation period wasn't consistent with this white spot, but was consistent more or less, or pretty near the system 2 speed,
really,
and able to deduce the rotation rate, which I think was 9 hours 50, I never remember the minutes, but something like 30 seconds plus or minus about 3 seconds, and whatever the number was, it's now within half a second of what? I mean, this was the real uncertainty was a few seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But there's sort of a chance, I think, that it came out to be recently what the number is known to be now.
This business with the old Shane data,
yes,
that was pre-discovery, that was published, all that?
That was published, yes.
In the Australian Journal of Physics?
No, Nature.
In Nature?
And these other ones, myself and Shane, we published in the Australian Journal of Physics.
But then you dip back into ionospheric.
Yes, and also there were some site we wanted, people wanted. At this, by 1955, the design study started on the Parkes, what was to be the Parkes 210 telescope. Mm-hmm. Got somewhat involved in setting up sort of some equipment to measure the noise at various sites. The idea initially had been to pick a site which was fairly convenient to Sydney, but after doing these measurements, what was fairly apparent that we would be taking a chance if we stayed on the coastal side of the dividing range. Once you went beyond the dividing range, of course, you couldn't measure any noise.
Mm.
So you only got lower limits. And ultimately, in the site, we had a few sites out west. And one of the things that influenced the Parkes site was that there was some shielding between the Parkes township and the site. Remember in 1957, went out with, on one trip with Wild and Sheridan, the idea was we'd use an aircraft to measure the shielding effect of this range of hills in between Parkes and the site where we are now. And we were able to measure a figure of, which sounded much better when it was expressed as a power ratio, and a power ratio of about 12 compared to what you got on the other side of Parkes, where there's no hill. So this was one of the factors that went into picking Parkes. After that, Bloomberg had announced his MESA, solid-state MESA discovery in 1956. And that the physics section of CSIRO in Sydney, inside the one building that's radio physics and standards, national standards. And there was a fellow there named Bogle, who'd just come back from Oxford, but he'd been doing paramagnetic resonance and was interested in these MESA applications. So 1957, it appeared that mazes would have, might be useful things to the radio astronomy, so that some Bogon and myself have went into a joint investigation of some mazes problems. We didn't ever get as far as getting a receiver actually on a dish, getting near to that point when parametrics seem to be offer a very much simpler solution to the problem. Well, I think the mazes would have been very difficult to use it past the early days. It's possible you could use them now, but I don't think you could have them.
Why not?
Well, first you've got to have the access to the large supplies of liquid nitrogen. And the way it was in Australia at that time, it could still be. It was very difficult to import helium, so it was always necessary to recapture what evaporated, and it presented some big problems. How we were going to do it out on the site near Sydney was just sort of, this was on a sort of something like a 30-foot transit telescope, which Frank Kerr Heinemann and so on had used to survey H1. But there, it wasn't very high. You could get the helium down through a big tube and put it into a bag, and then you'd have to have something as a reservoir, and you could compress it again, put it in cylinders and send it back into town, and they'd purify it again and re-liquefy it. But we didn't do that. And I'm pretty pleased that we didn't use it at Parkes. Well, when the telescope at Parkes was nearing the completion, John Bolton came back from Caltech, it was about 1960, and he sort of supervised construction mixer receivers with a pattern on the ones that he and Gordon Stanley had been using at Caltech. At the same time, another chap, Doug Millen and myself, made a sort of cool parametric for the use at 20 centimetres. So when the telescope came in, we started with these mixer receivers and changed it over to the 20 centimetre parametric.
Did you say cooled?
Cooled, yes. Just liquid nitrogen and so on.
Liquid nitrogen, which you would have needed helium for the masers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, no, orders of magnitude more difficult.
Right.
So this receiver was used in quite a lot of the early measurements at Parkes. Originally, Horsey, Roberts and myself had put in for some polarisation observations with the Parkes station. That was my first introduction to radio astronomy, but then Horsey, that was the end of 1961, he had this brain tumour trouble when he was visiting the States,
yeah.
So he didn't ever return to do anything in the way of active observing. And in March of 62, there were some trial polarisation observations which were not too successful. And John Whitehead came in with these. So he and Jim Roberts did these mainly because John Bolton decided that I should come in with him on a 400 megahertz survey of the sky just to pick out sources. So these two projects were on different halves of the night. So I didn't really get involved in the polarisation at that time, but then that was March. April, Bracewell came out, and you have no doubt heard all about the Centaurus polarisation observations.
Well, I've heard a little bit about it.
But and the story that he'd got the result from NRL. I don't know whether this is true or not, but it was still... He probably, I don't know, but he had been interested in Centaurus set with a fan beam. A ray of Stanford's and he and Cooper went in to do a map of Centaurus. 10 centimetres with a mixer receiver. It wasn't very good, but it didn't need to be very good on Centaurus. And immediately showed up the double structure of Centaurus, which they had known from the fan beam observations, but these showed that one of the sources was polarizing about 12% at 10 centimeters, and the other had polarization which was below the limit of accuracy. So that was really the start of polarization work. Parox. After that, in May of that year, between Whitehack and myself, did a series of 20 centimetres.
Excuse me, before you get onto that, back to the Bracewell
yes.
business. Now, so he detected this polarization.
Yes, in one concentrated in one component.
And then what's the rest of the story? I mean,
well, that was the only source where the polarization was determined at 10 centimetres. And at that stage, well, I don't think... I'm not sure that NRL had detected any polarization at 10 centimetres. I think theirs was a bit shorter.
62, that's right. I think you're right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, they'd seen we have a sensitive receiving system at 20 centimetres. Decided we'd try that in May of that year, and of course we found that polarization at about 20 sources, and of course that sort of whetted people's appetite for and sort of in Centaurus the angles were different than they were at 10, so around the end of May, beginning of June, while Cooper and Price did these measurements over a range of frequencies on Centaurus and showed the rotation of the horses, the square of the wavelength, the accuracy measured, and that sort of led on to the measurements Whitehake and myself did on a number of sources.
That was 62, now you
62, said that? Yes.
That was the first demonstration of Faraday rotation?
Yes.
In extra, in radio astronomy?
Yeah, radio astronomy.
Yeah.
Now, the only place it had been demonstrated before was in the ionosphere. There it goes from the moon, things like that. And then, 1963, was the OH announcement by Weinrich Barrett. Well, it was interesting that still have the records, minutes of a meeting proposed by, or called by Horsley in 1955, which we had a list of things which we should do with the radio telescope. They decided that the only thing that you could really do with a big dish, where it was really one out against other antennas, was spectral line work. Particularly absorption, and that's one of the things down the search for OH in Centaurus. The other thing was in occultations, where we needed the sensitivity and the resolution was provided by the edge of the moon. But of course, no one had thought of any OH, I don't think, again, until Weinberg and Barrett found it.
Was OH mentioned at this meeting, you say?
In 55, yes.
Yeah.
Well, that was when Horsley first came back from...
Was this based on the Townes?
The Townes paper.
At the Manchester meeting.
Was it Manchester? Or?
Yeah, I think so.
Yes. It was a Dublin IAU meeting.
It was a Manchester symposium.
Yes. Where Townes presented this. And OH seemed to be by far the best possibility once it got past H1.
But it was never attempted in Australia before the discovery?
No. Well, it could have been, and it could have been, of course, he stayed there. Well, as soon as this was announced, we tried to get something together to measure it, and of course, Sagittarius Well, the proposal, Horsey's proposal was to look in the Sagittarius books. It seemed to be the best proposition to some of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we looked at this and found this very odd. We found this near zero velocity where the H1 absorption is maximum. Found a bit of a thing like that. It didn't look much good. I'm surprised this baseline had been so bad, but that's how it was. But we sort of published this, and this was the first one to come after the Barry Library. But we weren't too happy about this. We said, oh, we'll try and get a bit better baseline and do it again. But then when we came to do it again, we found this was just part of a much broader profile. But even so, we only had a single channel receiver, and the local oscillators were not crystal locked. So it was quite a job going over all this profile. And it soon appeared that we hadn't gone far enough when the Harvard people discovered the minus 120.
Feature.
So we only got half the story, but at the same time we sort of found the 1612 and the 1729. Which weren't hard to do in Centaurus, even if you had a core system.
Yeah.
In Sagittarius, shall I say.
Yeah.
And beginning of 64, people said, oh, well, CH is the next thing to look for. The OH is enormous, CH must also be enormous. But so we had a search for that, and we got lots of ripples, ups and downs, but no CH9. No CH9 is still being found.
That's right.
And we started off on this search for them. So a mapping of the galactic centre region in OH. We had seen initially just with this single channel that in Sagittarius A the absorption was displaced a bit from the continuum of the peak. We had also seen when we came out the deck scans with this single thing a bit higher RA than and the Sagittarius A, the absorption, went on the continuum, you went up and you saw some very small component which has now become Sagittarius B2, but in the line you got something like that and then there was something which sort of went up again. So we knew there was some other region in the centre which had very high optical depths.
Were you Australians involved at all in the OH emission scramble, you know, in the States there were...
We had a look for some. No, we did never discover the anomalous.
This was only after this all came out that you then did any OH emission work.
Mm. Well, we still only had this old mixer receiver. We didn't have crystal locked oscillators still at the stage. But we went to the use of the multi-channel thing. 37 kilohertz and 48 channels. So.
Right.
This wasn't too bad with an OH.
Yeah, that made a lot of difference.
Yeah. We took a number of profiles along the plane, and if you naively divide the line profiles by the continuum temperature, you get distribution of apparent optical depth, you get things that are rather extended. So our first thing we showed in Nature showed things which were at more or less a constant velocity, but something of the order of, in some cases, up to a degree in length,
right,
which seemed to involve some very weird dynamics. Well, part of the thing was sort of signal to noise, and the other thing was the fact that just by taking the ratio of line to continuum apparent, as an apparent optical depth, you get, and when you're dealing with the sources which are small compared to the beam, you end up with the clouds which are about twice the beam size.
Right.
So this sort of made us think that I think instead of being sort of the beam was about 12 minutes a beam, it skipped up to approaching half a minute, and I'm not quite sure how we were able to get it to 1 degree, but they weren't right. Well, the 37 kilohertz resolution wasn't quite adequate on some of the narrow features, but it should have been enough for
In general, yes. Or was it?
That was 1964 at the time of the IAU. And then I think this is where we made the big wrong decision that we should have pushed on and got better equipment to do the mine work. But John Bolton made the decision that we'd put that money, the effort into the interferometer parks, so that we still didn't get anything more, and no more line work was really done until Weaver. There was one final CH search, which didn't show anything. And in between looking at Sagittarius, we looked at M17, which was about the same intensity. We said this would give us the instrumental effects, and then see if these recombination lines existed. But if you, in Kardashev's paper, gave his formula.
This is before you knew about any detection, so.
The Russians had said about.
Oh, you heard about the Russians, yeah.
In 64. This was the end of 64, or beginning of 65, and they had one on N minus one on N plus one squared equals approximately 2R on N cubed. So as we were doing these things, calculations the hard way, we adopted Kardashev's approximation. It gives you a line which is almost exactly halfway between the real lines.
I see.
So in our procedure, we just keep measuring along Sagittarius. Whenever the band pass would have fallen on a recombination line, we'd come back to M17. Of course, we were halfway between the recombination lines, so we didn't see anything.
Would you have had enough sensitivity?
Yes. But with the same system, Dick McGee and myself were able to do quite a number of sources, some of them, 30-odd sources, and detect. Things like M17, the line would come up in 30 seconds or something, even with that crystal mixes.
Yeah, sure.
But if you have the wrong formula, they don't come up.
That's for sure.
So that was another error.
Well, I think that's a good place to end, because I don't want to go...
I think that's sort of ending all the stories since then.
Well, but I think I'm going to end my history then, because it becomes just too big. Mm. So thank you very much.
Okay.
Frank Gardner also just told me about the fact that many of the CSIRO people, Pawsey and Piddington, studied under Redcliffe and in the ionospheric group at Cambridge, so in a large sense, not only Ryle's group, but also the CSIRO group originated at Cambridge. And he said that Piddington had a falling out with Bowen even before the war, and therefore it gradually faded out from radio astronomy. So that ends the interview with Frank Gardner on 21 February 73 at Bonn.